This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Cedarside. Cedarside's original 100% organic insect spray kills bed bugs, mosquitoes, fleas, ticks, mites, scorpions, roaches, and more, but is completely safe for your home, pets, and family. Go to cedarside.com, use coupon code Hoffman at checkout for free shipping, or call 800-842-1464 and mention you heard it here. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and I'm very excited about this upcoming podcast because it deals with a subject that I think is very, very important. You know, we often talk about terms like adrenal stress, burnout, adrenal fatigue, excess cortisol as being part and parcel of our overall health portfolio. And it's very, very important because the effects of stress on our bodies is huge. And today we have an expert on hand to help us understand this. He's the author of a book entitled The Role of Stress and the HPA Axis. We'll talk about what that is in just a moment. In chronic disease management. And let me sum it up. Here's my takeaway. It's complicated. It's even more complicated than we once thought. Today we're with Dr. Thomas Williams. He's a PhD and earned his doctorate from the Medical College of Wisconsin, where he studied molecular immunology. And he has a very, very sophisticated understanding of the relationship between nutrition and the human body. He is Vice President of Scientific Affairs at Ortho Molecular Products. That's a company that makes many of the fine supplements that we offer to patients, and some of which we actually offer also to listeners via drhoffman.com. Tom teaches at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Pharmacy, and he's a faculty member of the Metabolic Medicine Institute. And but his most impressive accomplishment, in my mind, in addition to writing this really wonderful summary of what's happening with our adrenals and all the ways that we can modulate adrenals via supplements and lifestyle, his most impressive accomplishment, in my estimation, is that what you have five kids?
Six.
That reads okay. I even undershot that. So you know, so he has certainly some intimate acquaintance with stressors, and so he's eminently qualified via his scientific understanding and his real life experience to talk to us about the experience of stress. Thanks very much for joining us, Dr. Williams. Pleasure.
Glad to be with you again.
Okay, so it's complicated. Help us break it down, because you know, we often talk about stress, and in your in this book, you actually criticize some of our common conceptions of how stress affects us, because a lot of people, you know, they talk about, well, my adrenals are burnt out, I have adrenal exhaustion, or they sometimes talk about, well, I've got too much cortisol, but maybe it's not all that simple, right?
Well, yeah, certainly I think the area of stress, we've known that obviously stress, whatever we've called it for thousands of years, you know, affects health, affects outcomes with people, whether we can define it in any, you know, definitive way or not. But really over the last 20 years or so, I think we've oversimplified the idea of the effects of stress, or what we'll call the HPA axis, and we'll define that in a minute. You know, we've oversimplified that concept as it applies to, you know, health outcomes, and use terms like adrenal fatigue as if, you know, the little gland sitting on our kidneys is just wearing out, can't handle it anymore, and then everything just goes to pot. And as it turns out, it is more complicated than that, or certainly we need to understand it in a way that's more important than that, and understand how the body manages what we deem, what we call stress, from all the different places it comes from, whether it comes from outside the body or whether it comes from inside the body, and the response. It's really the adaptation to that stress, and eventually either adapting well or adapting not so well, then generating outcomes that typically we would deem, you know, some sort of chronic disease manifestation.
Well, you, in the book, you single out the weakness of tests. I mean, what are some of the tests that are available to measure stress or measure adrenal
right.
function? Why don't you go through some of those and maybe...
One of the connections, and I think one of the reasons why we often think of it as adrenals, you know, somebody will say, I have adrenal problems or my adrenals are causing issues, is because some of the ways that we measure the stress response is by measuring adrenal hormones. So the two most common would be cortisol and DHEA, or its sulfated form, DHEA sulfate. And because we're measuring those two things, we can typically think we're measuring adrenal function. Well, what we're really measuring is the whole stress response, or at least part of the stress response as it pertains to what's coming out of the adrenal glands at any given moment. And, you know, part of the issue is over time we've learned a lot about how to do that. Obviously, if you take blood draws, which is a good way to measure serum levels of cortisol and DHEA, that is a stressful event. By its very nature, getting a blood draw for many people increases their cortisol levels. So that may be good in certain instances where we're just looking at sort of general ideas or measuring things in a clinical laboratory. But that's not a very good way to sort of measure, you know, whether somebody's, you know, basal stress levels as they're waiting for their blood draw. And in many cases, the dynamic changes of cortisol, it fluctuates in a circadian way, higher in the morning, lower in the, and later in the day. Very difficult to get blood draws throughout the day. So the other way that's very common is to do urine, and you collect urine over 24 hours, which is one common way to look for very high or very low levels of cortisol. But if you're trying to do it throughout the day, your urine obviously collects over several hours, and so it's sort of a general collection over several hours and not just at a time point. So one of the best ways that's been done is actually using saliva. And the convenience of, you know, being able to use saliva, spitting in a tube essentially, or putting a piece of cloth that can gather your saliva in your mouth and then spitting that into a tube, you can do that several times throughout the day. And one of the things that I point out in the book is that there's some really interesting dynamic changes that occur literally from the time you awake or in the morning to about an hour later. There's a dynamic increase, even above the normal increase that you see in the morning. There's a dynamic increase in that first half an hour that goes up and then comes back down. We call that the cortisol awakening response, CAR, and that dynamic change gives us some idea of the robust flexibility that's still going on, because it's really an effect. Not only really you're measuring cortisol from the adrenal gland, but it really is measuring what's going on in the brain, the hypothalamus, and a part of the hypothalamus that measures the light and circadian rhythm.
What you're saying is that, you know, commonly we give patients these kits, they take them home, we say, you know, when you get up, you know, we sort of say vaguely, when you get up, you know, spit in the tube, and then mid-morning spit in the tube, mid-afternoon spit in the tube, and then at night spit in the tube. But what you're saying is that really properly executed, this test should sit by the bedside, and at the first stirrings of awakening, the patient should do it, and then again a half an hour later, and then do another morning sample to see what the awakening response, what the CAR is, to actually gain more insight. Because you could have a normal, apparently normal test, but your CAR could give you clues as to your adrenal responsiveness.
Right. So what I've done in here is I've gone through what is typically offered, and what you described is what is typically what we call the four-point cortisol test, where they say get up in the morning sometime. And we actually looked through nine different laboratories that offered this test to see what instructions were given, what all the different parameters that were used for collecting saliva in a four-point test, and not two of them were the same. Which tells you that, you know, these labs are kind of all kind of doing their own thing. None of them actually give instructions that we found to measure the cortisol awakening response specifically. They all just have one time point somewhere in the range of from waking to, you know, within an hour. Some just say, you know, between 6 and 8 a.m. Obviously, if you have to wake up at 4 a.m. to go to work and you take your kit with you and have it at 7:30, that obviously has very little to do with what happened when you woke up. So we actually are actually advocating here for a couple different ways to use the standard four-point test, and then ways of advocating for laboratories to create additional instructions and tubes, because even though you're right, to catch that cortisol awakening response also requires the lab to have their reports designed to do that, and most of them don't have their reports designed to do a immediate upon awakening and then a 30 minute and then a 60 minute. They assume you're just taking one within that first hour, and it would really mess up their interpretive guides. So we're advocating that the laboratories actually catch up to where the research has been over the last decade and start giving clinicians and patients more tools in their toolbox to be able to catch that very dynamic first awakening response for cortisol.
Well, here's another problem, and I'm sure you're very well aware of it, is that recently one of my labs that I've used for many years was taken over by another lab in the name of efficiency and consolidation, and I started sending samples to a new address. And I started getting test results all of a sudden that showed that patient after patient after patient had adrenal insufficiency, had very low levels of cortisol. And Then I noticed this, and I asked my front desk, I said, could you please bring me all the samples that were done by this new lab? And there were 26 samples, and I found that 24 out of 26 showed that patients had adrenal burnout or adrenal insufficiency. So I called the lab, and, you know, I spoke to the lab director, and the lab director said, well, he came up with sort of Mickey Mouse explanation, saying, well, you know, you're in New York, and probably most of the people that you see are suffering from burnout. And I said, well, how come it was that I would get a fairly even distribution? In fact, the vast majority of my patients had excess cortisol because they're stressed out individuals. And all of a sudden, in switching to a new lab, all my patients had low levels. Now I switch to a new lab, and I'm getting pretty much 50-50 results. So there are inaccuracies in these tests. And then clinicians sometimes base their conclusions on that. They want to boost the adrenals. They use, like, powerful supplements to rev up the adrenals, maybe based on inaccurate information.
Yeah, so this is another issue that we ran into. Obviously, there's several different methods for measuring cortisol. I would say my experience has been most of them, if you stick with one lab and understand their methods, typically you shouldn't run into that wide of range. But what is also confusing is several labs or many labs use different reference ranges. So while they may have a similar outcome, one may call that normal, one may call that abnormal, and we found reference ranges, the width from high to low, which they would determine as normal, twice as wide in one lab versus another. And so in some, you're going to find more out of spec or out of, you know, range people in one lab than you would in another. And I think a lot of that has to do, especially in the morning, with the vagueness of when to take the test. If you're not very careful in how you're describing when you should take the saliva sample, then the range of patients' results are going to be all over the place. But some use micrograms per deciliter, some use micromoles, some report in the DHEA, if we want to move from cortisol to DHEA, some report the sulfate form, some report the non-sulfated form, some report a single time point in the morning, some collect and pool together and give averages, and oftentimes they don't even tell you if they're averaging them or if they're using what point along the day they're using DHEA. And so we're really, it was kind of disappointing actually when I really started investigating this, that it does appear that the labs haven't really figured this out, or they're trying to figure out a competitive angle rather than just going to the literature and saying, you know, this is the most common way that these hormones are measured and interpreted in relationship to clear stress-related conditions.
So we're talking cortisol and we're talking DHA. What's cortisol and what's DHA for our listeners?
So So let's just back up one step. So when we talk about the HPA axis, we're talking about the stress response part of the body that is designed to take in the information. The H is the hypothalamus. So the hypothalamus is in the brain, and it's collecting information from all parts of the body, you know, blood glucose levels, blood pressure, water levels, and everything. And it's consolidating that information into a signal, which it sends to the pituitary. So that's the P part of the HPA axis. And finally, that takes that stress signal and sends it to the adrenal gland, and it produces the hormone cortisol. So the HPA, hypothalamus, pituitary, adrenal axis controls a number of different things, but it primarily controls the amount of cortisol, which is a hormone that is made in the adrenal gland. And cortisol is its generic name is it's a glucocorticoid. So it not only controls blood glucose, one of the things that it does, it manages circadian rhythm in most tissues. It also is an anti-inflammatory. So it's a powerful steroid hormone produced in the adrenal glands primarily, in, at least in humans. And it has an effect on almost every tissue in the body, including the brain, where it actually goes and tells the brain to turn off the signals that produce cortisol. In another layer of the adrenal gland, the DHEA, which is a hormone that is a precursor to androgens and testosterone and others, and it's produced primarily in its sulfated form. Actually, the most common hormone we have in our body is DHEA sulfate. And there's a big question about exactly what DHEA does. We know that it is, we can say it's a counter-regulatory, or it balances the effects of cortisol. It maybe only does that through its production of androgens. Or it may have its own. We don't even know yet if it has its own receptors. Interestingly, really over the last several decades, has been the discovery that DHEA and other steroid hormones, not cortisol, but other steroid hormones in the DHEA and pregnenolone family, are made in the brain. And this is actually something that's relatively unknown to most clinicians, and it's sort of a new area we call neurosteroids that we're trying to kind of investigate what's going on with the brain making its own steroids. But many of these actually could be protective against overproduction of cortisol, which can be very damaging on tissues.
Could we oversimplify to some extent and say that a typical imbalance for some people who are stressed is high levels of cortisol, a stress hormone, or high effects of cortisol, because levels may not indicate effects in your sophisticated explanation of this, and DHEA is suppressed. It's sort of like a seesaw, in that we can actually suppress high levels of stress hormone by sometimes administering DHEA.
Right. There's actually been several animal studies and in human studies. One in particular, which is a very concern for a lot of clinicians, is the use of corticosteroid therapy. So you're giving prednisone or other steroids. Well, they have some of the same effects, some of the same anti-inflammatory effects is usually why they're given. But they also have some of the same, what we call catabolic, breaking down effects. And one of those that is very well characterized is the breaking down of bone, osteoporosis due to giving somebody corticosteroids. And there's been several studies, or a prednisone, and where you give DHEA to those people at the same time, and it protects the bone from degrading. So we see that in, there's a number of animal studies, but there's quite a few instances in human clinical trials where they've been able to block that effect. Now, we would assume the same effect is going on with the normal body cortisol, but it's more dramatic, obviously, when we give prednisone.
Yeah, it's a little segue on that subject is a type of DHEA that is often pitched as a safer form of DHEA, because we know that DHEA may augment female and male hormones. It's a precursor to estrogen and testosterone, and that's a concern perhaps for prostate cancer, breast cancer, hormone-related cancers. A quote, safer form of DHEA that has been pitched is 7-keto-DHEA. You talk about that in your book. What's your assessment of that?
So DHEA can be converted into several different downstream metabolites, And one of them moves over into a series of modified versions, which are we call 7-hydroxy. And there's an alpha and beta form. And one of the intermediates is a ketone, which we call 7-keto-DHEA. And the makers of 7-keto-DHEA tell us that because that pathway from DHEA to those forms doesn't go backwards, it can no longer then be used for making estrogens and testosterone, and therefore it's safer. So it's an intriguing idea, but unfortunately, what most people believe that the actual functional pathways for most of DHEA's function actually work not by becoming 7-hydroxylated, but actually via the other pathways. So we really limit a lot of the benefits we get when we try to use a form like that. And interestingly, the World Anti-Doping Association that kind of looks at precursors bans DHEA, but it also bans 7-keto-DHEA as a precursor. So, and if you look at the head-to-head differences between these two, really the only area essentially that the 7-keto form has been used or in clinical trials is for weight loss. And I would say, if you look at the use of DHEA and 7-keto-DHEA as far as their efficacy for weight loss, frankly, the DHEA works just as well, if maybe even better, in some of the clinical trials. So I'm not convinced that there's any real reason to use 7-keto. But I'd also say that if you have somebody who you're very concerned with as far as either an estrogen or testosterone-driven cancer, you would only give DHEA if it was low. So you wouldn't be using this as a therapeutic level to try to get some super high doses of DHEA. Do recall, though, that DHEA sulfate is the most abundant hormone we have. So it's a very, very safe hormone to have in the body.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I find it a very valuable clinical tool, but as you caution, I think it should be done under supervision, levels should be measured, and patients should be observed carefully. So, unfortunately, or fortunately, it's available on the market, and some people are, if a little is good, a lot is better, and probably they're not doing themselves irretrievable harm, but, we should nonetheless be cautious. So coming back to, on a more fundamental level, what are some of the major sources of stress? We use this term stress. It's sort of an all-encompassing term. But you break it down in a very sophisticated fashion in your book, The Role of Stress in the HPA Axis and Chronic Disease Management. Stereotypically, stress is like bad things happening, but it goes beyond that, doesn't it?
Well, if you ask the average person on the street, are you stressed or do you have stress, they will almost always answer in terms of, those things that they can measure. And almost always it has something to do with time or expectations and job stress, things that are expected of them something like deadlines coming up, and those are the things that we think of. And so what we did is we stepped back and we said, what does the brain perceive, or how does the hypothalamus, essentially the one that's controlling the process of the stress response, what is the triggering mechanism? And certainly what we deem perceived stress or mental and emotional stress is a big part of that. And we talk quite a bit about those sorts of things that are new to people, things that are unpredictable, things that threaten us, things that where we have lost control. Those things will always stress our brain. Public speaking, those kind of things, those are the traditional things. And the way that the brain interprets that, so if we have any sort of neurotransmitter imbalance, depression, anxiety, those will affect how we perceive the events happening around us. So those perceived events are both real and, the way that our brain interprets them. But really, there are a lot of other bigger stressors. I mentioned that glucose is managed by glucocorticoids, which is cortisol. Mm-hmm. And so glycemic dysregulation, where our blood sugar is going up or our blood sugar is going down, is going to be a major stressor. And the body is going to try to regulate your blood sugar using cortisol. And so, especially if you're hypoglycemic, either because you've consumed too much food and you now have that post-lunch lull, your body's going to try to kick in and produce cortisol. So anywhere somebody's having glycemic control issues, they're going to have a stressor on their body.
So it's a form of diet-induced stress. So our diets can actually be a stressor for us. There's such a thing as a stress-modulating diet, and there's a stress-inducing diet.
Right. So, you know, people that are consuming high glycemic index foods, low fiber, and they're trying to, obviously they're producing lots of glucose, or their body's trying to absorb a lot of glucose, and they're producing lots of insulin to dispose of that glucose. And if they don't do that fast enough, then they're going to be hyperglycemic. But if they eventually bring that down, it's going to be hypoglycemic. So it's like the roller coaster kind of situation. And as it turns out, the stress response is affected both by the hyper and the hypo form of blood sugar issues. But I mentioned before that cortisol is your body's strongest anti-inflammatory. So anytime you have inflammation in the body, whether it's infectious disease or maybe you have food allergies or just airborne allergies, gut inflammation of all kinds, arthritis, cardiovascular inflammation, or really obesity, which is a low-grade inflammatory condition, all of these are going to be triggering the brain to say, it's a stressor, I need to produce more cortisol, and therefore it's going to be creating a stress response in the brain. And lastly, one that people obviously realize is a stressor, but I don't think they often realize how important it is anything that disrupts their circadian rhythm. This could be short-term things like jet lag, or even daylight savings, as a matter of fact. But people that are working second and third shift, their circadian rhythm is very closely tied to the stress response. And so if you're constantly fighting against that, or if your sleep is poor, obviously people know that when they sleep poorly, they have a difficult time dealing with stress the next day. So these are all things that we need to think about. And most of the time, if you deal with those four stressors, the perception of stress, the circadian disruption, the glycemic control and inflammation, you're probably dealing with 85 to 90% of those things which are going to be that the brain is going to be perceiving as stress and trying to adapt to.
Okay, well, this is a good point at which to pause, because we generally divide these podcasts into two parts. So the subject is stress and the role of the adrenals and all the body's regulatory mechanisms in coping with stress, whether it's perceived psychological stress or whether it's dietary stress or whether it's inflammatory stress. There are many sources of stress in our lives, circadian stress, as Dr. Williams has mentioned. The book is The Role of Stress and the HPA Axis in Chronic Disease Management, and it's a very sophisticated discussion of stress. It's actually aimed at health professionals, we will also make it available. We'll make it available to health professionals via the website, thelifestylematrix.com, for all health professionals. Or for non-health professionals, you can go to orders@pointinstitute.org, email orders@pointinstitute.org. If you want to become super sophisticated on the subject of stress, this book covers all bases. I recommend it highly to all my professional colleagues and also sophisticated listeners. When we return, part two of our discussion of the role of stress in the HPA axis in chronic disease management with Dr. Thomas Williams. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.